The Mike Lupica Podcast.
New York Daily News columnist and best-selling author.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we'll be talking with my pal Michael Wilbon of Pardon the Interruption on ESPN and their NBA coverage. But before we get started with Michael, this from Geico. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. Welcome to the Mike Lupica Podcast. My guest today is one of my favorite people in the business, and one that I really thought that I once engaged in a mentoring program with. We put him on the Sports Reporters. Before we knew it, he's on Pardon the Interruption. Now he's on the Big Fancy Pants NBA show. Does he ever call me on my birthday? No, he does not. Do I ever get a Christmas card? No, I do not. He's one of my favorite Northwestern people as well. Michael Wilbon. Good day, Mr. Wilbon.
Good day. You look so young, I didn't think you had birthdays anymore.
Yeah. There's so many things to talk about in the world of sports right now. We're going to get to as many of them as we can. But let's start with Pardon the Interruption, because I think I've told you this before, way back before the beginning. Before the beginning, like in the Old Testament, before the New Testament, Mark Shapiro took me out to lunch one day, and he laid this thing out, and he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "What are you asking me to do this?" And he said, "Well, I just want to know what you think about it." And I said, "Well, I can't do a 5 day a week strip show." I said, "But it sounds fine." And before we knew it, it had become this monster show. And Mike, one of the things, other than the obvious way that it just works between you and Tony, it has become so imitated for the clock on the side. And did you guys ever know when you made it a thing that it would become that big a thing?
No, because Michael, you know Tony and me well enough that we didn't know television. We played at it. We didn't know it. And luckily, Mark Shapiro handed everything over, the keys to the car, to a guy named Eric Rydholm, who said, "You know what? Because you guys are happy to admit you don't know anything about television, let's play it like that and put the clock and the rundown, which every show always had, but only in the room, never on the screen. Let's just put it up there and just admit to people, here's what's going to happen, and they're fine with you knowing it." And it was Eric's idea, it's just funny how, you know, 2 weeks after it happened, people started going, "Oh my God, why didn't we think of this?" And luckily, we had the guy who thought of it.
Mike, you know, we're talking to Michael Wilbon on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Michael, you know, way back at the beginning, the description of the show was the conversation that you and Tony had had for years in the sports department of the Washington Post. Are you surprised that it has lasted this long? And surprised that it has survived everything that has happened at your company over the last few years?
Yes, Michael. And of course, the crazy thing is, it's the conversation that all of us had with somebody.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, to me, that's the secret, is that it's a relationship show. It's the conversation. Everybody screams at somebody about sports, whether it's on the phone. Now, of course, you know, technology means it's, you know, texting or whatever you do. But there is someone you disagree with, whether it's a parent or a sibling or a friend or a frat brother or a former roommate. There is somebody. And I think that's everybody can identify with that part of it. I don't want to be immodest. I thought this can work, because remember at the time, Michael, Sports Reporters was the only commentary show that ESPN had.
Right.
They didn't want it. They were scared of it. they wanted highlights. They didn't want people to actually comment on the news of the day in a way that sports reporters did or that all of us did in print. And so, I thought it would work, but to the degree that it did, no, I cannot sit here and say that.
You know, it's funny, Michael. After it was announced, it was announced right around the Super Bowl last year that Sports Reporters was going off the air, and people wanted me to be devastated or sad, and I said, "Well, wait, we ran for 28 years, and we didn't think we'd run for two. I mean, when we first started doing the Sports Reporters." We were always happy that they let us come back the next Sunday and do it. And you know, you started out there. Tony started out there. Schefter started out there. The one thing we take great pride in is there are so many people, the ones who have survived at ESPN, who made their, Jamel, made their chops on sitting with us on Sunday morning. And you're right. It is a chemistry thing. I always joke with Bob Ryan. I said, you know, you pulled me in the lottery and Kornheiser pulled Wilbon. That's just the way it shook out. I mean, you were unlucky in the draft. Michael went to pick ahead of me.
You know, Mike, and the sports reporters, there must be another phrase other than training ground I could use, but in doing sports reporters, which all of us loved so much for so many years, as you just pointed out, there was substance. There was substance and a level of depth. Michael, think about this now. And anybody that you have known in sort of the last, 8 to 10 years, everybody specializes. They specialize in something. They cover one thing. Who are the people out there left on television who did everything? Who went to a NFL game on Sunday and had to write a competent piece? And then with whether it was the Garden or the United Center or the Forum on Monday night to cover an NBA game, and then wound up doing a news story and a profile later in the week and a college game on Saturday, and then on maybe boxing 2 weeks later, and you learned all of it. No one learns all of it anymore. Everybody specializes in something, and that's not what any of us did. And so we're the last of them. The people that you're mentioning now, and that's the sad part to me more than any particular show moving or morphing, is that people don't do that. They're not even allowed to do that anymore.
We're talking to Michael Wilbon on the Mike Lupica podcast. Michael, it's so true. And for all the fun you have and all the fun we have, and we would get into it on the Sports Reporters, and you and Tony get into it all the time, they're not shouting shows. They're not shouting shows. They were never shouting shows. And I can remember we would have people come on the Sports Reporters, and then I'd see them say or write somewhere, oh, I got the better of him today. I said, no. That's not what we're doing. That's not what we're doing here. We're having a conversation. And the reason, pardon the interruption, has lasted, and I hope you last as long as the Sports Reporters did, the people watching feel like, even though they don't get to be heard, that they're part of that conversation.
That's right. It's not a contest. I tell people it isn't a contest. I tell this the same thing, Mike, when they wonder about it or they say, how do you guys feel when you come? It's like, it's a conversation. It's going to go on tomorrow. You know, it's going to happen. I said one of the sentences you never hear on some of these other shows is, you know what, you made a good point. And those were things that we needed to say and that we said, on Sunday morning. And then now Tony and I, occasionally anyway, you better acknowledge that or the product is not genuine.
Yeah, Mike, it's what has happened to the culture, though. I mean, I've been working. Bob Costas and I've been working on his book, and we've done most of the heavy lifting. But he talks about this a lot. You know, we grew up in a time where, like, Murray Kempton and William F. Buckley could come at an issue from completely different, opposite points of view, but they didn't have to then tear down everything the other guy stood for and call into question every opinion he'd ever had. And in the words of President Obama, we didn't live in a culture where everybody was constantly going to their respective corners. Okay. It wasn't like that. You could have a big heated argument and say, you know what? That made a lot of sense. The other side is never allowed to say that anymore because
right.
It's Mike. It's like you're given ground.
And you know, Michael, we were with Bob. Bob Costas was here in D.C.
Oh, God, he made some headlines, too.
Last week he did. And what was great about it is even acknowledging that, which you just did and Bob talked about last week, that's not even allowed anymore. It's funny, it goes back to something much more serious than this, but I think at the same time, in a slightly lighter way, I would tell Tony that one of his favorite shows, American Idol, I would say, you know what? Everything has become so uncivil. It's the Simon Cowling of America.
Yeah.
And I don't, what is that, 15 years ago or slightly less? We got to the point where you just had to undress somebody. It wasn't enough to even, criticism wasn't good enough. It had to go to ridicule. And that's all we're left with now. You have to undress somebody and embarrass them and humiliate them. And I'm hopeful that we don't get to that. And even on the loudest day, people see there's a twinkle. And at some point, yeah. And Michael, what's also important is sometimes it's okay to disagree in getting to the same place. But all of those nuances are lost now. In fact, I don't know that there is any nuance. I can't wait to read what you and Bob, I can't wait to see the finished product, because I think that more than just acknowledging it, but that conversation desperately needs to be had.
Yeah, it's a conversation that is ongoing, and you know, it's almost like you can't stay ahead of the events. We're talking to Michael Wilbon on the Mike Lupica podcast, and we're talking right now about Pardon the Interruption, which has been such a hit show for a long time, and you know, it's much the way we thought we were the gold standard on sports reports. You guys have become the gold standard for that kind of show, and it's funny, Mike. It's not like when the show started out that anybody was coming up to you and Tony and saying, "Hey guys, who'd you have to screw to get the 5:30 in the afternoon time slot?"
No, not at all. Michael, because you were there for the incubation of this, and even before the incubation started. You know that nobody was going to quit their day job to do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I remember when people said, okay, you're going to do this, and what about the Post? And what about the Post? What about that? I mean, we're not going anywhere. And so for 9 years, I did both.
Right.
I mean, I started to reduce the column and going from four to three, but it was still three to four columns a week and covering events. And still a lot of sports reporters. I didn't want to give up anything, because what was the guarantee that was going to fly? And at 5:30, at a time where I remember so naively, Michael, saying when people were explaining to me what kind of rating they would accept and what would keep us on the air, and people at the time talked about a 0.3, because Close Up had done a 0.3, and they took it off the air for us. And I said, well, suppose we get a, and they said, if you get a 0.4, it's great. Get a 0.5, we'll keep you on the air. Get a 0.6, we'll tear up your contract and give you a new one. And I naively said, suppose we get a 0.9, a 0.8. And they said, listen, idiot, only Oprah does that at that hour. You're not doing that. And, you know, and back when ratings still were something that we recognized, that weren't all microscopic in this industry, we would do a 1.7 or 1.8 on Mondays in the NFL season. So you knew this, and I think the handful of people who understood what it is that we thought of what we had as columnists at major newspapers in America. No, people were not saying, people were not scratching their eyes out for 5:30 television, nor were they saying, we're going to quit everything we've done for the past 25 years to do this.
Oh, yeah. And Mike, but here's what you didn't know, and no one could have known at the time. Maybe Shapiro, who's a very smart guy, knew this. You tapped into college kids sitting around the dorm rooms at that time of day. And everything that happened, you became must-see TV for kids like the Lupica boys, okay, who are back in their rooms at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Sure, and that's we didn't know that. And I remember going to Syracuse to do a Georgetown-Syracuse game, you know, one of 50 of those that I did over my life. And I'm just walking over the dome through campus. And literally, you know, kids started to come out and say, hey, we love this new show you're doing. And I'm like, what is going on here? And this happened maybe a dozen times in just the walk that I had of less than a mile. And that sort of tipped me off a little bit that this could be different. That I was on a Syracuse campus on some snowy day in February going to a Georgetown-Syracuse basketball game, and these kids recognized me. And they weren't talking about the column, of course. And so, you know, I think Shapiro did have an idea that, Michael, I remember one day the funny line that Tony and I talked about that you had when you talked about dorm room kids and shut-ins. And we laughed about it thinking,
I did say that.
And so we talk about that now, and that line was uttered, I think, probably on a Sunday morning, you know, when the three of us were doing Sports Reporters in 2000 or 2001, long time ago.
Yeah, we're talking to Michael Wilbon, my pal, on the Mike Lupica podcast. Has there ever been a point where you considered stopping and not doing it?
No, because it's become my identity. And I hesitate to mention the two people I'm going to mention because growing up in Chicago, I do what I do. I want to become a columnist largely because of them. But I mean, it's become for us on some level, a lesser level, I'm going to say in an artistic way, like Siskel and Ebert, where, you know, and I grew up reading those guys as columnists. They were columnists to me. And of course, to most of the world, they were guys that were, you know, at the movies or, you know, whatever the show be, the title when it changed when they went to PBS. But they were columnists. They were the Chicago Sun-Times and Tribune to me. And when I was growing up, writing a column like they wrote a column was my goal. And so, no, I mean, it's become the identity. It's way too much money to leave. I got a 9-year-old. I got to keep working for a while. I don't just buy houses like Tony on the Monopoly boards. That's what he does now, even on his own block. It's a real life. And from the impact standpoint, when I'm on the road somewhere and players or an owner will come up and talk about what we've talked about,
right,
or people call before a show or after a show because they want to influence what is going to be said, or maybe just cooperate if the phone call has gone out to them first. So from a content standpoint and from just a personal life standpoint, for always, Mike, I never thought that this would replace what we did. I never, ever believed that, but it has.
You know, Mike, it's funny because, I sometimes feel like I'll be the last person, you know, in the news. I'll be turning out the lights in the newspaper business. I'm actually writing between the Daily News and politics and sports and Sports on Earth. I'm still writing like 5 columns a week.
I don't know how you do it. I'm not saying that because I'm on with you. I don't know how you do that anymore.
It just feels like a natural thing. I got up yesterday and wrote a column that I just thought was the right thing to do about Bobby Doerr, and it turned out to be tremendously well received, talking about the friendship between him and Ted Williams. But this is a long way around of asking you, do you miss writing a column?
Yes, I do. And Mike, I have a platform to do it if I want to, because I can do it on the Undefeated, and I've done it a few times, and I've had things that got, you know, they tell me, because I don't keep up with these things, even though I should, an admission about how old man I've become, you know, some of the biggest days on that site, which is, I don't know, the Undefeated is still less than 2 years old, maybe about a year and a half, and I can write anything, anytime there, and I don't do enough, and I'm embarrassed sometimes, and then I sometimes go places and people that, Mike, we've known in the business, whether it's on the journalism side or the sports side, for decades, and they'll say, why don't you write more? I enjoyed what you wrote last week out, you know, fill in the blank. And I only do it, wow, so. But on the other hand, Mike, I don't know if I can do it anymore. I wish I could do what you just talked about and what you just talked about, what you just did. I wish I could do that, but it's hard. Writing seems so hard to me now. And I miss it. Yes, I miss waking up in the morning and either sort of engaging in that or putting the piece together. Somebody asked me yesterday about writing a piece dealing with what happened in the Garden the other night with LeBron and the young Knicks rookie point guard, Nil Aquina. I loved that and what it could mean for the future. And Enes Kanter, a guy who, sort of like LeBron, doesn't mind standing up to his own president. And then gets in these dust-ups on a basketball court. I think, you know, there's so many things out there now. But I sort of get it out in these other forms, in these, you know, minute-and-a-half chunks. And is it enough? No. But you and Costas, you guys may inspire me to go back to what is the reason I do this, to go back to what gives me the greatest joy and fulfillment, which, you know, only that can do. Only the thing that you love the most can give you that kind of fulfillment, and writing a column did that.
We're talking to Michael Wilbon on the Mike Lupica podcast. All right, let's talk about the NBA. And you just referenced LeBron and Cantor and the French kid the other night. What I said after that game was, Knicks win stare down, lose game. Because Michael... I love seeing Cantor stand up for the kid. They were spoiling for a fight, but Michael, they poked the bear the other night, didn't they?
They did.
Didn't they, Michael? They poked the bear.
They did, and that was. I'll hint to this, as I'm sure it was off the record in some way. But I got a nice text about that moment from somebody who used to be involved in them all the time, even in the Garden that you and I covered his entire career.
Yeah.
Who appreciated it the same, of course, not the same way, and only the way he could, in a way, that moment. But Mike, and this is one of those things, I guess, that has to play out before we can decide what it means. Will that impact the Knicks going forward in a way that losing the game and winning the stare down actually helps the team? So not just the next time they play LeBron, but going forward, is it going to band them together? Are they going to get a bit of a chip on the shoulder that stays there and becomes a boulder? Is Nilakina, I liked his just shoving LeBron, just saying, get out of my way. Right. You know, you're so desperate to slobber all over Dennis Smith, you think I'm nothing? Get out of my way. I thought it was great. I mean, for all the moments that, you know, people go crazy over the NFL and they were watching Monday Night Football, most of them, I wasn't watching Monday Night Football in another awful game in what has become a dreadful product most nights, most Sundays.
Oh, wait, Michael, we're supposed to blame everything on Colin Kaepernick. Don't you know that?
Yes, I saw that memo somewhere. But Michael, I was rousing the old man, your friend of decades, Tony, to say, turn the Monday night game off. Turn the Knicks on, you knucklehead. Turn them on now. It was fun. It was, I mean, you had entertainment. There was a level of play in that game, even up 23 and blowing it, that stupid Monday night game didn't have. And so I thought already that the NBA had one of its a moment that could mean something. Look, if the Knicks just sort of step back and just retreat, it won't mean that, Mike. But I sort of prefer right now that it means something, and let's see where it goes over the next 4 months.
Well, it's a great thing in New York for the place to love Porzingis the way they do. The fact is, they're still not very good. And I think, the one thing that concerns me, and for all the early speed and all the wonderful basketball ways, Porzingis is a freak. We all know that. He's a physical freak. You can't put him in any sort of box. He can run the court. He can shoot threes. He's 7'3". There's never been anybody quite like this with this amazing skill set. Michael, the one thing I worry about with him is I think that being the man can still grind you down. And it's going to be interesting to see if he has the stamina to be the man over 82 games.
You know what? And Michael, I mean, everybody has to watch to figure out. He's got to prove, you know, he has that. I wonder about this. And we talked about, you know, a European player, Nilakina. There's only been one guy, only one European player, I think, has been the man in that way, and it's Dirk Nowitzki.
Yeah, right.
And I think it's got to be harder to do it in New York. It's got to be harder to do it in the Garden. It's got to be harder to do it with a whole level of expectations that Dirk, to be quite honest, even though he's a Hall of Famer and an all-time great, didn't have to deal with. I wonder about all of that. Dirk's been the only one who the other players have been. Tony Parker's been great for a long, long time, but he didn't have to carry it. And so I like to watch Porzingis to see that too. You know, does he have the personality to do this? And he's got to be surrounded by some characters. I mean, I don't think he can just be the focal point all the time off the court as well. I don't know how you put up with that. I don't know that people from other, I mean, Yao Ming didn't have the body to stand up to it, even though he seemed to have the personality. Speaking of just other internationals who got involved at that level of our game. I love that Porzingis is now that character. I hope he can withstand it. I really do, because it's a great story if he can.
We're talking with ESPN's Michael Wilbon on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Michael in a minute, but first a word from one of my favorite things in the world, Audible. Audible makes getting more books in your life easy. What's not to love about that? They have an absolutely unbeatable selection of audiobooks, all that with fantastic performances. You can easily transform your long commute or your ride with Audible, as I do. And I'm telling you, whether I'm in a train or a car, I do this all the time. Right now, you can start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. You have to go to audible.com/Lupica. Audible has an outstanding collection of exclusive originals, short stories, comedy, all of that. Plus the best of news podcasts like this one and more. Handpicked and continuously refreshed. Be sure to check out audible.com/Lupica to start your 30-day trial and get your first audiobook free. I'm calling them today. I want at least one free. You know, Michael, sometimes if you live in New York, it is still difficult to process that in the last 17 years, think about this, Michael, in the last 17 years, the New York Knicks have won one playoff series.
Oh,
they have won one playoff series.
Wow.
In
who
the
they
last
beat in that series?
Huh?
Who they beat in that series?
They beat the Celtics.
Okay.
They beat the Celtics before they lost to the Pacers in six games when we all thought they were going to go to the Final Four and play the Miami Heat.
That's okay.
They lost the first game of the Pacers series at the Garden. And then, if you remember, there was a moment in Game 6 in Indianapolis where Roy Hibbert blocked Carmelo when the Knicks looked like they were coming back to win the game and force a Game 7. They beat the Celtics that year, Mike, and they were up like a bazillion points in the game that closed out the Celtics, and the Celtics made this big rush at the end. And that was the year that Carmelo was the third in the MVP voting, and J.R. Smith was sixth man of the year, and this is a pet peeve of mine. They were coached by a guy who now can't get a head coaching job, Mike Woodson. How this man, the only guy who's given them any real success.
You know, he won 54 games that year.
Yes, he did, Michael. Yes, he did. And not only have they only won one playoff game in 17 years, I believe that they are neck and neck and may have passed the Timberwolves now for having lost more games in the sport over those last 17 years than anybody.
No.
So these people are so hungry at Madison Square. Let's talk about
it, Mike.
That.
You can hear this. A quick point. You can hear it literally on the television when you're watching. If you've been in the building enough, and obviously, my God, I have over 35 years. You can tell. There's a sound that comes over the TV from that crowd that tells you that, if you know what to listen for. And it's like, wow, this would be kind of cool if they were good.
There's an old expression by an old Philadelphia guy named George Casita, who once talked about at the old Garden, the monster of Madison Square Garden, which he described as being something that lived in the throats of 19,000 people. It would be nice to, and Mike, here's another thing I say about the Knicks, and I didn't mean to get sidetracked on the Knicks. We didn't know how good we had it in the 1990s, whether they won a championship or not. They went to the finals twice, Patrick and Riley and then Van Gundy and Oak and all those guys. And Michael, in those years, as great as the Yankees were at the end of the 1990s, the baseball season did not start in New York City until the Knicks stopped playing. That's how big a deal the Knicks were. And listen, the 70s will always be the 70s at Madison Square Garden. I tell people all the time, you go back and think about what it was like to be there when it was the Knicks and the Pacers and the Knicks and the Heat. Michael, you know, it was awesome.
It was great. I loved being there for all that stuff, and I hope it happens. I hope it happens again soon. You're right, it's been so long. I don't even come to Knicks games. And by the way, speaking of Patrick Ewing, you got to come and see your guy. You know, it was a nice little debut he had. And some of us are hoping, who've known Patrick all his life, that this is more than just a nice little story.
Michael, let me tell you something. And you know this. Not everybody knows this, but you know this, okay? When he was with the Knicks, we always had a great relationship. He knew, I mean, if I need to get him on the team bus, he would get on the phone of the team bus. We had a relationship that stood the test of time. Michael, there was a point a couple of years ago when people mistakenly thought I was leaving the Daily News. And I just let the day play out. I knew it wasn't true, that there was not any truth to the story, but it was my turn in the barrel. I told my kids, don't pay attention to anything you hear. I'm not going anywhere. Okay. The day plays out. And I didn't go on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook. I couldn't issue a statement. Okay. But the phone rings at 9 o'clock. I've talked to everybody in the world that day. Okay. And a voice says to me, did you get fired? And I said, no. And the voice said, well, thank God, because if you did, I'll never get a head coaching job. And it was Patrick.
That's great.
Because I had been beating the drums. Mike, the day he got the job, I called Jeff Van Gundy. Dave Chekich called me. We were giddy because we had started to believe it was never going to happen.
Yeah.
For a guy this worthy to have a job. No, Jeff has said this for years, Michael. No great player ever went back and put in the time to work to do this than Patrick.
He didn't ask for this sitting from the table. He did. Yeah, he worked. I'm thrilled. It's here in town, and I have my fingers crossed that it all goes well. And for somebody who, you know, has known Patrick since he was 18, I'm thrilled for him. And so I'm going to try. I couldn't make it over to the opener the other night, but I'm going to get to a game.
No, soon. I promised him I'd go down. He wanted to know if a Boston College man would wear a Georgetown basketball cap, and I said I will tell you. I'll tell you one more story about Patrick. And I love Patrick Ewing. I loved his heart. I loved his talent. We all saw those two ice packs on those knees for that whole career, and he never complained. Okay. I had a rather prickly relationship with his college basketball coach.
I can remember something like that.
We had a difficult relationship because, as you know, I didn't think he was doing Patrick any favors by creating a culture where he was as suspicious of the media as he was. And one of the wonderful things about seeing Patrick Ewing as a coach now, Michael, is people are getting to see the personality that we've all known about.
That's right.
For a long time.
That is absolutely true, Michael.
So one night,
it's fun. It's fun to see that. That's the side of it. Other people to see what we see.
Michael, it's awesome. So one night, I'm standing on the floor at Madison Square Garden when I was still welcome there, and the Knicks are warming up. And the big guy, Mr. Thompson, comes over, and we're standing next to each other. We spoke. It wasn't like we didn't speak, but it had been difficult. And he said, "You know," he said, "we have two things in common." And I said, "What are those, Coach?" "We both love mystery novels," which is true. And he said, "And we both love Patrick Ewing." And he smiled and he said, "To me, that's a good enough basis for a friendship. And we've been friends ever since."
That's great. I didn't know that story. I'm glad to hear that. All these delayed years later.
"We both love Patrick Ewing." And we all used to ask that question. Okay. Patrick, Alonzo, DeKemp, blah, 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 blah. I said, "Who was your favorite?" And he would always look at me and say, "Patrick came first."
Yep, Patrick came first. That's right.
And it's been wonderful to see the affection and the friendship and the loyalty. And for Michael to be there the other night, the other day, was great. All right, let me talk about LeBron because it's a segue into Michael. Where do you think he's going to be playing basketball next year?
Well, if I had to bet right now, I would say Los Angeles, just for a number of reasons, including talking to star players around the league right now who would never talk publicly about it but who have their opinions privately, right, of course. Just listening to them, like only listening, saying to them as they say to each other, "So what do you think is going to happen next year?" And that's the answer I get. Although they hedge it too, Michael. There's a wince, and they say, "I think Los Angeles." If I had to handicap it right now, I'd say, I don't know, Los Angeles would be at 40% and Cleveland might be at, you know, 35%. And maybe there's some mystery place we don't even know of at
New York City?
Well, the only thing I think is he's become such a West Coast guy. And I know that from my own sort of developed love of the West and talking about, you know, being out in California. And I think that that could have happened the last time around, but because it didn't, I think, I'm hedging mine too, that we're looking West here. Maybe one more year in Cleveland, but it depends on how the Lakers go. And here's the thing. So much of it depends on the appeal, and you know how great this is, of one Irvin Johnson.
Right.
I mean, Magic hasn't even – people can talk about tampering if they want. Magic hasn't started recruiting LeBron yet. He hasn't. He wouldn't even – it didn't even matter what he would say last year. People think Magic is stupid. So Magic, at some point, and that will be Magic who recruits him, not Irvin. And he will recruit LeBron, and you know that's going to be difficult for LeBron to say no to. And I think it's going to be there, and I don't think it will be the Clippers. I think it will be the Lakers. I think sometimes these obvious things are the correct answer. But I think he has to look at what young Ball is becoming, and God, Kuzma is the best rookie on the team right now. And there's so many other factors. If things went on, he loves the Duke kid. You know, they got a lot. And then what's Paul George going to do?
Right.
Is Paul George going to go and be his Scottie Pippen? I think there's a lot there's a lot of moving parts. And if any one of them doesn't move in the right direction, maybe the answer is no. But I think where we sit today, that's what I would say, hedging it all the way though.
I'm talking with Michael Wilbon, the Mike Lubica podcast. Here's what I think about LeBron. I believe he's the greatest all-around basketball player in history. I think his skill set's like Magic, except he's bigger and stronger and just simply more athletic. And I believe, Michael, across his career, and you also factor in that he has been the greatest teammate of his generation in addition to everything else, he influences a basketball game in more positive ways than anybody I've ever seen in my life loving the sport. In addition, maybe Irvin could have done this too. He could have been an all-star at any of the five positions on the court. He's an extraordinary basketball player. And I always make that case, Mike. And then I say, but if I had to pick one of them to play for my life, I'd pick Michael.
There it is. That's it. If you had two circumstances. I was in a Cleveland barbershop and was stupid enough to get involved in one of these discussions last year.
Mike, can I just stop you there?
I know. Why was I in the barbershop? I was accompanying a relative.
I just felt I had to ask.
Say that line like I once did, can I? So that's hysterical. But I said to them, let's forego all of that we're talking about, and let's get to this one point. If with 12 seconds left in the Game 7 of the NBA Finals, you had to put the ball in anybody's hand in the history of the game, but we'll narrow it down to LeBron and Michael.
Yeah.
Who would you pick? And they got silent. And that was the only time they got to everything else they thought they had an answer for. And for that, they didn't have an answer because there's only one answer. And it's like going back to when we used to have the conversation about Kobe. You know, Kobe and Michael. And it would be the same question and the same answer. To me, Michael, LeBron is going to retire as one of the five greatest players of all time, if not there already. But if I had to choose a game and my life was at stake, or a moment and a championship was at stake, I'm choosing Michael Jordan. And I still, when I get people who are millennials who want to find a reason to say, oh, you're just an old man and you're still picking Michael, I go, okay, your life's on the line. Tell me who you got. And there's always, 100% of the time, a silence because we all know what the answer is.
When I was a young beat reporter for the New York Knicks at the age of about 12, I was very lucky from the beginning to be embraced by Red Auerbach. His best friend was Paul Sand, who was the editor of the pre-Murdoch New York Post. And Paul had called Red and said, you got to take care of this kid. And it began a friendship that lasted until the end of the old man's life. Okay. So now it's the 50th anniversary of the NBA in 1996. And everybody's making their all-time this and their all-time that and this list and that list. And I said, wait a minute, I don't need anybody else to make a list. The old man was there when they opened the place for business. He's still around. He's the greatest executive of all time. He's the greatest coach of all time. I'll just call him and have him make his all-time team, which he did. It was for a column in Esquire. And then I said to him, okay, I said, Red, Michael or Russell? And there was a long pause at the end of the phone, and he finally said, Jordan. I said, whoa.
That must have shocked you. There had to be a time where you did not know the answer was coming.
He said, let me explain. And he said, and it showed how current he stayed until the end, Michael.
Yeah.
He said, I got to sell tickets too. And he paused and he said, you got to be realistic. And I thought, what a wonderful answer that was. What a nuanced, wonderful answer was. Because, Mike, we both saw it. I was there when Michael made the shot against Georgetown, Patrick and Georgetown, to win the national championship. And then followed him all the way through and always had what I felt was a pretty good relationship with him because I knew I knew what I was saying, okay? And there was a time in this country where the highest praise you could pay to an athlete was he had Willie Mays in him, okay? And it's a generational thing. But now it's Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was the main event for me. And I can't imagine that somebody will not be, and I've loved watching Tom Brady, for example, okay? And there have been baseball players since Mays, but Michael was the main event for me. And it will be interesting to see over the rest of my life if anybody can change that.
It will be. There've been three people that changed the way I lived. No one of them, Michael, meant in a professional way, literally. The number of flights, the number of nights worked, not to mention being a kid from Chicago, and that changed it in a whole different way. But there were three people to me in sports, and I guess I could put them in any walk of life, but they changed the way I lived, and they were Ali.
Yep.
And that played out over my entire childhood, and then even early adult life, and then Jordan. And you know what? For a brief period of time, Michael, Tiger Woods.
It wasn't so brief, Michael. I've always said this, okay? It was Michael, and then it was Tiger, and then it was LeBron. I think so that you're talking about
10 years means it's not that brief, is it? And Tiger
No. And you know me. I've been playing golf since I was 9 years old. I've occasionally played it at a pretty high level in my life. My handicap's been as low as 3. By the way, I will tell you my one round of golf with your partner. I understand that Mr. Kornheiser is a better golfer now than he was when he played.
All he does is play now. You would think he's on some senior tour.
Yeah, okay. So we're playing at my club up in Connecticut, and we're having a very nice day. It's nice a day as you can have with Tony, you know, just with the anxiety and the constant, you know. And you know I love him, but it's tough.
It can be difficult.
You got to wear it. Okay. And every time he would hit, Michael, this is true, every time he would hit a bad shot, he would look over and say, I'm sorry, Michael. And about the 8th hole, I called him over. I said, Tony, I love you. I said, I love you. You've been my friend forever. But I said, stop apologizing after you hit a bad shot. And he said, why? And I said, because, Tony, I don't care how you're playing. He said, what? I said, Tony, I don't care how you're playing. I only care how I'm playing. And it was like liberating for him. And I think Tiger, the ball even sounded different coming off. It's why what happened to him, Michael, more than Mike Tyson, more than anybody, it's the most stunning fall I've ever witnessed in my professional career. If somebody had told you when he won the Open at Torrey Pines that that would be his last major and that everything would happen that has happened.
No
and
way.
It would be this, you would have had that, Mike, you would have
a
that person
novel.
Drug tested.
A bad novel is what it would have been. There's no way. And you know what, Michael, for people who just love everything from the appreciation of the performance and the art that he made it, the art form that he made it, to the excitement of it, to the storytelling part of it for us, there's an emptiness to me from April through August, and I know that now we're almost, we've done without it as long as we had it.
Right.
You know, 97 to 08 was when we had it. And even though he played well, you know, through 13 not in terms of non-majors, we haven't had that from, it's almost 10 years. It's 9 years since we had him in Torrey Pines. There's an emptiness there. I mean, the summer's not been the same, none of them, in terms of that performance and appreciating what a human being could do and the theater he could produce. And so Tiger is part of that equation, that triangle to me with Ali and with Jordan, but I don't expect to see it. I don't expect to see it. If surprise me, good. I mean, if I'm stunned, if it happens, but I, you know, when I sit around now and tell these stories, and I was in Charlotte a couple of weeks ago when Michael and the Hornets had an enormous event they have where they basically honor heroes and military and education and business and different walks of life. And he even said to me, stop sitting around telling these stories. You sound like an old man. Stop doing it. And I said, okay, that's fine, and that's what should come from the person who's the object of all of this, but I'm not going to stop because there's nothing like it. And even you know, I was telling kids in our PTI newsroom yesterday, about LeBron. There is some access to LeBron, depending on who you are and how you go about it and how long he's known you. There's some access there, but we don't get to see, because the world has changed and there have to be security people all over the place all the time, and there have to be. I understand it. When he's in an arena, there's not the interaction anymore that Jordan was able to have, even though Jordan was the most famous person on the planet, literally. There isn't that. And I wonder how, like, are people going to have these stories about LeBron? Are they going to get to see behind the curtain at all with LeBron? And I hope they do, because for all the reasons you mentioned, LeBron is, I mean, he's the person. I don't know. Is there a soccer player, a single player right now? Is Messi equal to LeBron?
Nah, Ronaldo, LeBron, I mean,
worldwide?
No, I mean, there's a Messi and a Ronaldo. I actually don't think so. And Mike, listen, here's the thing. We've both been fortunate in our lives to see amazing things with our own eyes. Okay. I was there for Gibson's home run. I was there the night the ball rolled through Buckner's leg. I saw Joe Carter hit a walk-off home run to win the 3 weeks ago. I'm at Minute Maid Park. And it's 13-12, and it's the greatest game of baseball I've ever seen in my life. Okay, so I've been very, very fortunate. But there will never be a more theatrical event that I have witnessed than the day this man came back from minor league baseball in, what, 2.5 weeks later, scored 55, as Spike called it, the double nickel, 55 points at Madison Square Garden against the Knicks. It was the single most theatrical sports event I've ever witnessed.
That's saying something. I mean, I remember being, and LeBron would not affect it this way. Well, and maybe just major media, maybe mainstream media can't do anything like this anymore because the times have changed so dramatically. But I remember my sports editor saying, here's the deal. And he didn't have to twist my arm, as you would imagine. He just said, you just get on a plane and you got to go wherever Jordan is the rest of the year. That started with the game in Indianapolis when he came back. He just said, just be on a plane. You got to be where he is the rest of the
year. I was on a plane that we were all, I'm back. That was it. That was the statement he released that day. And we were all on our way to Market Square Arena and not knowing that he was going to duplicate what he'd already done, that he had won three titles in a row. He was going to win three more titles in a row. And I will always believe if he didn't go away, he would have won eight titles in a row. All right. But before we go today, this is the week when GQ called Colin Kaepernick its Citizen of the Year and got everybody's hair on. Well, not yours. Everybody's hair on fire. Michael, you touched on it before. I sometimes think that Colin Kaepernick gets blamed for everything except that the fact that the Giants suck in the NFL this year. Okay, I'm surprised that Colin Kaepernick isn't blamed for losing the election for Hillary Clinton. Okay, but one thing I think people are starting to figure out is that this was never about the military. And one thing I've said about him, and there were things he said and did that I hated, okay? I hated the socks with the pigs on them, all that stuff. But, Michael, dissent in this country is as much a right as standing or kneeling for the national anthem. The same freedoms are, oddly enough, tied up in the same thing. And I said to my 93-year-old war hero dad, I said, Pops, what do you think about this? He said, we didn't just fight for some freedoms. We fought for all of them.
And I said, that's as well put as I've heard it. That's as well put as I've heard it, Michael. And I have some mixed feelings about Kaepernick.
We all do, Mike. We all have mixed feelings
about it. And mine, some of them, you know when he sort of lost me, and I'm trying to get over this one point? Because if they're going to be mixed, they can't all be negative. When he said I didn't vote, I was done. Done. I got two parents, black parents who grew up in the South in the Depression, to whom the word vote, it meant more. It meant it was equal to the word freedom. It was the ultimate expression of one's freedom that they didn't have, even 75 years after slavery, they didn't really have it. And for Colin Kaepernick to say I didn't vote, it just meant, oh my God, you now want us to identify with a particular freedom you're interested in expressing, but you don't understand the fullness of the word and the concept.
Mike, he's one of the non-voters that got this guy elected. That's who he is.
That's exactly right. He is. And so I'm trying to suppress that a little bit, because I thought that he was, look, there's no question he is the one who made the sacrifice, because sacrifice means cost, and it has cost him. It will cost him the back half of a career. But there are better spokespeople for this. At a time where presentation means way too much, Michael Bennett is a better spokesperson. Doug Baldwin is a better spokesperson. There are people who understand it as fully as Kaepernick. They did not make the initial sacrifice, but they can articulate this position at a time when the words social media mean way too much. And they can do it mainstream or social media. I mean, when you hear the first day Michael Bennett took this up, I was like, yep, he's the guy who, if he'd been on the front end, if he was the first guy, this might have turned out differently. Or some of the other players, Michael, whose dads, or moms maybe, but dads we know of, were in the military. This is not directed at the military at all. And no matter how many times people say, hey, listen, idiot, my dad served, and I also want to shed light, bring attention to this issue. People don't hear the back half of that. They don't want to hear it. They want a crusade. And so Colin Kaepernick, I know he made the ultimate sacrifice here because he gave up something. I was reminded of this. I was at a function. I mean, it was a wedding, Michael, this summer. And somebody stuck out his hand and said, Mike, you don't recognize me. There's no reason to. I'm John Carlos.
Oh,
and you know,
really?
For somebody of our, yeah.
Wow.
I had, okay.
See, now you've impressed me.
Well, but you know what? It was a moment. I had to recover from that.
That's pretty
you
cool.
You know, and he's standing there, and he looks great and distinguished. And it was just a wow moment. And so there are people that understand what actual sacrifice is, because they give up something. We praised justifiably Muhammad Ali to the heavens. When he passed away, there was sacrifice. Those 3 years were sacrificed. And so I know Kaepernick has done this, and I need to remind myself of that. But there's times where I just thought, wow, I wish he could have completed this. I wish he could have stayed engaged. He didn't. He's not engaged now. There are others who had to run the race, and he started. So I got to get over that. I wanted somebody perfect to be on the other on the end of that representation, and that wasn't that. It didn't turn out like that. And there are others who had to pick up the cause and run from there, like Michael Bennett. But man, Kaepernick, he has become the lightning rod. Isn't it interesting? I wonder how he's going to be looked at 20 years from now.
It is going to be interesting. All right, here's my last question for my pal Michael Wilbon. How'd that dynasty you were building at Wrigley Field work out for you?
Well, I, I don't Dynasty is not going to happen. But you know what? I like it just fine. I do. I like it just fine. I would love to have won a second one consecutively. But I think that when Theo came, this was great. He said, look, the goal here is to make the playoffs 7 times in the next 10 years, which means there are going to be 3 times where we don't even make the playoffs. So listen up. And I thought while setting the bar high, he didn't set it impossibly high. And I think this group can be more like, you know, everybody wants the Bulls in that town, Michael, as you well know.
Yeah,
you were there for all those.
Sure. Oh, I love Michael, I love Chicago. I love Chicago.
It'd be more like the Blackhawks, who didn't win 2 in a row, but who won 3 in a 5-year span because of the silly rules of that sport, which basically force you to tear down a championship team immediately and reconstruct it. And so baseball is not that. You can win back-to-back. I mean, we don't see it often. You can win back-to-back, maybe not if you're not the Yankees, but because they're the only ones that have done this in a way, since Toronto, I guess. But I like where the Cubs are. I like where Theo is. I like the common sense approach. I'm excited about this next few weeks and bringing in a pitcher or two or three because they got to reconstruct that staff without Arrieta and Lackey. But I feel good about the Cubs. I do. And it doesn't mean that I think they have to win. But you know what? When you go your whole lifetime and don't see a World Series appearance. I'll just say this quickly. My mother is 92 years, will be 92 years old in March, God willing, 91 years old now. And I don't think she would have gotten to 90 to 91 without the Cubs. I've talked to her doctors about just spirit and adrenaline and outlook, and I don't think she would she be alive right now without just wanting to see that Cubs season. I think we were going to lose her. We were certain of it. And there's so many stories like that in Chicago, particularly, where people held on to this. And anytime something means that much, you don't take for granted one. And so I, you know, it took me 56 years to get to 57 years to get to one. I'd like another one, but I'm not going to be like all these college football fans who think it's their birthright to go 11-1 and they fire somebody because they go 9-3. I don't want to become that fan. I don't want to become that guy. And I told my son, who's my 9-year-old, whose only experience with the Cubs now is 3 straight trips to the National League Championship Series, and he had a long face and said, Dad, I thought we could win this year. And I said, dude, your entire life has been going to the playoffs. They've gone to the playoffs 5 times in your life. They didn't go to the playoffs 1 time until I was until I was 40. So let's not become that fan. Let's not become an SEC football fan over the Cubs. So I'm hoping that I can heed my own words and not get too crazy if they don't win one for a while.
Michael, thank you for doing this. We're obviously going to have to do this every couple of months. You watch him every day with Tony Kornheiser. Oh, tell Kornheiser, by the way, I still have the same phone number. Every day on Pardon the Interruption, 5:30 Eastern Time. You can watch him on NBA Countdown. He's all over their NBA coverage. He's one of my favorite people in the business. I'm so happy for his success. This is the kind of conversation. This is why the numbers are getting crazy with this podcast. This is why we have this thing. Because I talk to people that I want to talk to, and download, subscribe, leave a comment in the reader's comment section, and we'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.